we are going to start out. He is the 2000 Olympic gold medalist. He is a two-time Ironman world champion. And this summer at Challenge Roth, he did the fastest ever iron distance race in history, 7:35.39. Please give it up for the amazing Jan Frodeno.
Hey, everyone.
Hey. So before we get into our fun Q&A stuff, one of my favorite things is giving out grants, man. You change people's lives. Pretty fun.
Sounds great.
Don't you think?
Let's do it.
So this is a young man we just met this evening. He has spina bifida. He's in ninth grade on the honor roll. He wants to join the high school track team and needs a racing chair. Didn't have a racing chair, so he can't join the high school track team. He wants to go to the CIF championships, and we thought, you know what? What if we brought him to the Tri Club of San Diego meeting and showed him this racing chair, which we're going to be giving him tonight? It's a $3,000 racing chair. Let's bring up 16-year-old Andy Estrada Ramos.
16.
Yeah, 16. Yeah. So what do you think?
Well, pretty amazing.
Pretty amazing. So what is it about track that you like? You're pretty emotional?
Yeah.
So Jan, this is the payback for all the money you guys raise. This is the payback because you get to change somebody's life with a piece of equipment. Jan, why don't you help me pick this thing up so people can see what this thing looks like? Do you mind?
There you go. Whoa, oh, it's stuck. There we go.
Look at this thing. $3,000. Of course, yours will be fitted exactly to you. You pretty excited? And the entire family is here. Thank you so much for coming. And so, Andy, the cool part is, from now on, you are part of the CAF family. Sweet is what he just said. I love it. How about another round of applause for Andy? Thank you, buddy.
Hey, buddy, I heard you're going to be sweating a lot, so I figured you need a trademark headband. This is what I race in all the time, so I figured you need one of these to kick some ass out there.
Wow! Thank you, buddy. Awesome. It's a good way to start, huh?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, go, T.
Nope.
Okay. You just yell if you get something that sounds like or looks like. Yeah, there you go. So, Mr. Frodeno, how you doing?
Pretty good. Happy to be sitting, you know, chilling out before the race, not standing around too much.
I like that. So, born in Germany, raised in South Africa, when did you get into, what were your sports before getting into this whole swimming and triathlon thing?
No sports at all. My family is truly intellectual. Whenever there's any sports on TV, the TV gets turned off or the channel changed. And I had to find my own way because, yeah, I was always hyperactive and always wanted to be around. Could never lose.
Right.
I always bored games. I was terrible. So the enthusiasm got hold of me. But really, I only learned to swim because my mom was scared that I would drown when I go surfing. And she sent me to swimming classes, and my enthusiasm basically turned me into a pro athlete.
So from that, your mom was scared you're going to die in the surf, so you get into swimming. At that point, did you start thinking, I mean, after a little while, that, gosh, I could be really good at this, the swimming part? Or did that lead to triathlon?
It pretty much led to triathlon. I was in a pretty humbling group of Olympians and really fast swimmers who, took no turns in showing me that I was not the most talented in the group and that they had been around for 10 years and wouldn't let me take over the reins anytime soon. And it was something, however, you know, my coach, he won an Olympic gold in 1960, Hungarian guy, proper hard ass, you know, one of those guys who just every day, we started off with 2Ks, I don't know how many yards that is, of butterfly, every day.
Of butterfly?
Butterfly, first thing in the morning, 6 o'clock, you know. our pool had no heating. It was not necessarily the most scientific approach, but it definitely helps for Ironman training.
You knew how to suffer early.
Yeah, it kind of it shows you that you need to love what you do, otherwise you won't persevere. And that's really what he did. You know, he threw a lot of eggs against the wall, but those that didn't break really turned out to be great athletes because they absolutely loved what they did.
So when did triathlon come into your life?
Triathlon came to my life through a guy called Konrad Stoltz. I think he's...
Oh, yeah. Caveman.
The Caveman. He's quite well known around the States. He used to swim with us at the Lifesavers. I got into lifesaving a little bit after swimming. And every Sunday, this guy would come around, and then he would go to the Olympics and put on a performance of his lifetime. You know, he came out the water second last, rode up to the front group, then broke away, and then died a slow death. But anyways.
We can forget about that part, yeah.
Yeah, well, he gave it a shot, is what I'm trying to say. He gave it a shot, and he came home from the Olympics really having given it his all. And that was the moment, Sydney 2000 Olympics, when I knew triathlon, I wanted to be there. I wanted to, go to the Olympics.
And when did you became part of the German team in what, 2002, 2003, something like that?
Yeah, 2003, I got into the national program. I was basically growing up in South Africa at the time. My family didn't have much, and my dad ended up selling his road bike, which he had at the time, in order to get me a ticket to fly to Europe. And I was taken up by a triathlon club. They put me up in one of the hostels, and I could sort of race for them on a borrowed bike, a 1986 Colnago steel bike, you know, the bottom tube shifters and all of this. But I think maybe the swim school is what really showed me that I want to be here. I want to succeed. I want to get to the top, and I just absolutely loved it despite the conditions. And made the national team, and from there on in Germany, we're quite fortunate. There is a bit of funding, there is good coaching especially, which is obviously valuable when you're a young kid, and that's really what got me into the pro ranks.
And there's also, what, Bundesliga? Is that that's pretty intense racing.
Absolutely. In the Bundesliga, we had, pretty much, I think every pro athlete has probably done a Bundesliga race in their life. Back in the day, it used to be a little bit bigger, which is sort of, you know, up to Olympic distance, some super sprints, some sprint distances, a league, and you race for your club, five guys, and gets a bit of a team feel, which is never a bad thing. You know, I guess you guys, being part of a triathlon club, know the gist of having comrades and people to suffer along with. And that's kind of what we did, just, all sort of trying to make it as pros. And some of us did, and yeah, that's how it came about.
So heading into, you make the Olympic team for 2008, right, for Beijing. And heading into that, had you won a World Cup race?
I had won a French Grand Prix.
Had you won a World Cup race?
Nope.
No.
Okay. I hadn't won anything.
So,
big.
Going into Beijing, it was Javier Gomez, right? They're already planning the victory parade back in Spain.
Actually did. It was one of my biggest motivators when I heard he had already planned his party before the Olympics. And
yes.
I was like, you're not planning my party. My party. I didn't say that to anyone else except myself.
But you were saying that while you were doing, you trained for pretty much that whole year, knowing it's going to come down to the last couple hundred yards of that race.
Well, my coach at the time, Roland Knoll, who was a professional athlete himself, and I, we were adamant it would be. You know, the racing at the time was very much a flat bike, and then everybody was waiting for the run, and it sort of headed down for a sprint. And that was also Javier Gomez's only weakness. So that was really our only chance at trying to win this thing. And I think despite the fact that we'd never won a big race, we did believe and we did have the firm goal to go there and win all out, go big or go home. And that's how we prepared. You know, we were doing sprints and more sprints and more sprints and another sprint. And that's really, you know, what the whole focus was based around. And it took a long time, but sort of it was probably about 2 weeks before that the switch in my head flicked and I could actually believe that I could do this. You know, because it's one thing to say I can do this and I can, you know, all this big talk and chest pumping, but it you really have to believe it unless you actually have your mind tuned in with those thoughts. It's not going to happen. And you know, the thing is it Yogi Berra, I think?
Yogi Berra. Yeah. It's not over till it's over.
Yeah, and he I believe he said, whether you think you can achieve or you think you cannot, you're probably right. So whatever you believe, your mind is the most powerful thing. And that's really, I think, where the Olympics was won for me.
What I love about that race is, you know, you try to put yourself in that person's position, and there's, you know, Bevan Doherty, there's yourself, there's Javier Gomez, and I'm sure all three are going, we got medals, we're on the podium.
Simon Whitfield was there too.
But he was behind. You guys had dropped him, right? So you're going, there's three of us, and we just dropped the 2000 Olympic gold medalist, Simon Whitfield, so we're sort of golden. One of us was going to get gold, but I'm pretty much good until Simon Whitfield all of a sudden came back from the dead, and he's right with you. So now there's four, and there's three medals.
To be honest, I think between Bevan and Javier, you know, they started playing paper, scissors, rocks, who would win, because they didn't count on me anyways.
No.
And then Simon came in and just threw his hat. Literally, he did. You can actually see on the video. He came up to us, took his hat, and threw it away, and then just started sprinting before the finishing straight because there was still a turn to go. And then we ended up on the finishing straight, which was about 400 meters to go. And I was just really, really grateful at that moment that it finally started. You know, I'd been preparing for this month, for this sprint, for this closing, you know, finishing straight for a whole year. And finally it started. So it was actually quite a relief when he went.
And if you think about it, it was a great move on Simon's part. I mean, the reality is he took people by surprise. He made the move. And at that point, he was pretty much guaranteed a medal. And so if people didn't react quick enough, fortunately, all that sprint work, you reacted quick enough, beat him by 5 seconds, got the gold. But he sort of stole himself the silver. That was a great move.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and even for him to come back, you know, after he was dropped already in Olympic distance racing, generally, you know, if you're dropped, that's the end of your day. You know, you kind of make sure no one else is coming from behind. And it just showed the character of Simon and why he is one of the greatest champions of Olympic distance racing.
So you win the gold medal. You'd never won a WTS race before. How did your world change winning this? All of a sudden, you're on the top step, right? You're hearing your anthem.
Yeah, it was pretty surreal at first. You know, you dream of this a thousand times, and then you all of a sudden becomes real. But you're not quite sure whether it is real or not. So wherever I went, I made sure I kept my medal close and was always in my pocket. And was the best security controls ever at every airport. It's like, oh, sorry, I forgot about this.
Oh, that's just my gold medal from Beijing.
Yeah, it's nothing like a little bit of showing off. But yeah, to be honest, it was a little bit like somebody pushed a fast forward button in my world. You know, things just started happening and going crazy. And it was a lot, you know, for a young guy, when somebody pats you on your shoulder and tells you you're the greatest every day, eventually you start to believe it, and you need some good friends to pull you back down to earth. And you know, after a few months some good friends, that happened, and the reality of training began again.
What was the coolest part afterwards? The people you met, things you got to do as a gold medalist?
It's hard to single out one event. It was well and truly an absolutely amazing time. You know, there were so many functions, so many cool things you get to do. You get to land in the cockpit of a 747 at your home airport, and we had the fire brigade do like a champagne shower for the plane. You know, it was some pretty unique stuff with it. But I must say, nowadays, in hindsight, it's definitely, you know, it's shown me that world is fantastic to be out there and to experience all these crazy things. But in the end, swimming, biking, and running is my favorite thing to do in the world, and I'm quite happy that I stuck with it and found that way again.
So how do you compare, for most of the people here, we've never done draft legal. How do you compare that style of racing to what you do now? How is it alike, and how is it different?
Well, it's alike in the sense that the order of sports is the same. And everything else is vastly different. You know, even the Olympic distance racing has changed tremendously. The biking is a lot more aggressive these days than it used to be. And the guys are actually really good riders compared to probably what we were at the time. But that being said, you know, the whole mindset and the whole going into a long distance race is so much different, because you know you will suffer. It's just a question of when. And that's really, I find that Ironman racing is so much more mental than the ITU. The ITU is a lot about competitiveness and nerves and game face, whereas Ironman racing is a lot about being one with yourself and seeing how far and where your limits are.
And I remember reading something where you were, actually, I think it was one of the interviews we did where you talked about, if you want to talk about what's terrifying is the last hour of an Ironman, just because you're trying to get to the finish line, you're just trying to keep moving, but you don't know if you can get there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole thing, let's be honest, if you stand at the start line and you think you're about to swim, I'm sorry, I'm still not familiar with miles. I think it's 2.4, 112 miles of biking and 26 miles of running.
Yeah.
That in itself is pretty terrifying. You know, it's not something that gives you goosebumps of excitement. It's not like it's, wow, this is going to be an awesome day. So really, it's always about perspective, you know. And then you set your mindset, you get the positive thoughts, and break it down into small little pieces and make it manageable. And then on a day like today, I rock up here and I get a totally different perspective again, you know, and I think our suffering, I mean, seriously, harden up. It's nothing compared to what the people who get supported by this wonderful foundation go through. So it's very humbling to be here and actually see that compared to what, you know, what we do.
So after you win the gold medal, obviously everybody thinks you're going to win every race. At 2009, 2010, how tough were those years just going in as, hey, oh, well, we've got the Olympic gold medalist. Did you feel that pressure?
Yeah, that pressure is always there, and I'm very highly expecting of myself as it is. But to be honest, what was lacking was my goal. It was what I was mentioning earlier. You know, I kind of said I want to be the next world champion. I said that out loud. I went to interviews and was like, yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be the first. But really, I didn't have the drive. I didn't have the motivation. I didn't really know why to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go out and punish myself through these sets, because really, you know, it was, yeah, I enjoyed the Olympic preparation, but it took me probably another 4 or 5 years to realize that that was the end of an era. I was happy with my Olympic career and I was done, and I probably just retired from the Olympics 5 years too late.
Well, it's funny, because when I look at your career, in 2012, if you're just reading a stat sheet, you go, okay, he was sixth. But the reality, in your mind, that was one of your best races, because you'd been injured most of that year. I think you only ran for, what, 6 weeks leading into that race?
Yeah, and when you realize the Olympics is much of a runner's race, you know, you have to run a sub-30-minute 10K. That's just to even feature anywhere. So 6 weeks of running is definitely is not enough. But I definitely had one of my best mental performances ever, you know, just going through the motions and trying to just stick it out for as long as I could. I was really happy with that. But of course, if you come in as the Olympic champion and you get six, you know, you sucked, basically.
How tough was the transition when you went? Because when you're talking about the Olympic distance, now you're moving up to 70 points. You're doubling, right? How tough was that, just the training and the volume? Were you able to handle it? Obviously, you were able to handle it, but how did you handle that mentally? The mental part is always the toughest.
To be honest, the mental part was the easiest part, because through a former bike sponsor, I went to Kona, and they... they opened that world of long distance triathlon to me. You know, before I was always saying, yeah, old slow guys, whatever, one day, baby pram, I'll go and do Hawaii, just because as a triathlete, you sort of, you should have done it once in your life. And I went there and I was really surprised by the whole energy, the vibe, and everything that surrounds this race. And that's all of a sudden very much changed my attitude in terms of sports in general, because I had a goal again, I had a vision again, and that paired with being injured for about 6 months and not knowing whether I'd ever be able to run again, sort of added a bit of gratitude and humbleness to my life, and it really made everything a lot easier because I really wanted to be there. I wanted to be good again. I had a dream. I had a goal to go to, and now it was all about finding a plan of how to get there and execute.
So your first full Ironman, Ironman Frankfurt, right? You've got, you know, Sebastian Kienle goes 8 hours, 7:55. Frederick Grandler goes 8 hours. You go 8:07 to take third, your first ever Ironman. What I love is three flats, right? Plus, when we watch you during the run, I could be wrong, but I think your first 10K in the marathon was 33, right? Something like that, 33 minutes for that first 10K. Did it seem like you were walking?
Yeah, I was obviously angry after having three flats. You know, you spend a bit of time on the road and you think, you know, you should be up there with the guys, and the race is crawling away from you. And then the first step I took off the bike, my quad just locked up and I cramped. And I was like, can't believe this. Anyways, I've got to get through it. And yeah, like you said, pacing was not my forte. I think it might have been 34 minutes, but it was, I think, 1:15, 1:14, sort of
through
first half.
Yeah, 1:14 through the half. And so we'd watch, and he's either running, you know, running 5:30s or walking. You know,
it was pretty much
one or the other. It's like, wait, is he, what? He's walking. Oh, and he ended up running 2:43, basically walking probably 3 miles of the race.
Yeah, I think someone counted. I stopped 27 times to walk. So.
it was
a long day out there, but Pete Jacobs actually taught me that you can walk the aid stations, so there were just a few more aid stations than I anticipated, which probably helped me a lot.
That was a good idea on Pete's part. Hey, I got an idea. You should walk the aid stations. Rookie, you should do that. So, first Ironman World Championship 2014, again third, and again, flat tire, blocking or drafting. I remember you coming in the transition, the T2, you came in, went out, came in. I'm like, what's he doing? You came in, so you basically came in and out twice, but you still got third place. Were you, just knowing that you were doing the first one there, were you okay with that?
It's one of those things, it was actually really nice to be nervous again. You know, you get into a routine, and when you're professional for 10 years, you've done the races, you go to the briefings, you're bored, and then, you know, the music before the start line gets you pumped up, and it's routine, blah, blah, blah. Whereas I sat at a race briefing, and I had to listen, and I was like, oh, where do I go, and this, and what, I need my bag, and somebody, I don't have to rack my own bike, and it was all very confusing and new, which is what made me look like an absolute amateur. Running into the tent, running back out, having forgotten to take off my suit, and then it was, the same thing happened to Rasmus Henning. No one.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did.
And can happen, and I'm kind of glad it did, because sometimes you just need that youthly naivety to come back, and if you can have a laugh at yourself and not take it too serious and not actually get angry and sort of take it, you know, without a chip on your shoulder, I think it was probably the best thing that could have happened to me.
So 2015 was one of those classic years, right? You win, you had a race here, Lionel Sanders, you've got Andy Potts, and you win here, then you win Ironman Frankfurt, Ancona. I mean, it was just one of those years where everything was great. Were you healthy all year long?
I haven't been healthy through February since I can't remember when. I always seem to have something in February. Except for this year.
There we go.
Yeah, now I'm just tired from training through February. But we'll see how that break works. But yeah, definitely 2015 was a magic year. Sort of everything came together. 70.3
yep.
Worlds was still in there, and a quick time in Frankfurt. It was definitely, Yeah, very good, where my coach and I managed to work out a formula of consistency. You know, we realized that it wasn't about putting in the big weeks. You know, my record week is somewhere around 49 hours with 28 Ks of swimming. What's mm-hmm. that in miles? Something, a lot.
A lot.
650 Ks on the bike, which is, for an Olympic distance athlete, is pretty decent. But 160 Ks of running, that's 100 miles of running. All in 1 week, you know, and I was super proud, and I was like, this is the greatest thing ever, and really it's rubbish, because the next week you end up doing half of that and being absolutely fatigued and getting no more quality, which is where getting a bit more of a scientific approach and having a coach to help me through those times, to guide me and really introduce a bit of common sense mm-hmm. from the outside really helped a lot and worked magic.
So one of the things that was interesting in that year, so you're the defending champion is Sebastian Kienle in 2015. And normally he's a back a little bit in the swim. And that particular year, he really wasn't far back. He was with you guys very quickly. And he's obviously an amazing cyclist. Did that concern you when he was up there that quickly?
Well, I knew that he was about two and a bit minutes down out of the swim. And when he was the first to bridge up to me, because I actually rode away from the bunch a bit after less than you, by the airport he had caught me, which is,
really
I don't know,
early.
Yeah, it's really early. You know, my first thought was actually, this is good, because he's burnt too many matches too early on. It's the kind of thing you pay for. And luckily it prevailed. He did blow up towards the end of the bike ride, and yeah, I was quite happy to see that.
So when you win, now you're the first person ever to win a gold medal in the Olympics and to win a gold medal at the Ironman World Championship. When you look at how your life changed with each of those, which one was more impactful?
Yeah, it's amazing, because when you're an athlete and you're preparing for Olympic Games, you know you've got one shot in 4 years. You get sick, you mess up your training, you eat something wrong, anything, and you're gone. So to nail one day in 4 years is the pinnacle of sports as an athlete. Yeah. But in terms of public perception and the whole hype around it, Kona was massive, was way bigger.
You know, really?
So it was totally unparalleled. It was really phenomenal, you know? It was from going to being, you know, one of the guys out there to, especially in Germany, being a triathlon nation, actually being a fairly big deal.
Did that surprise you, that it was actually bigger than the Olympics?
Yeah, it did. It did very much. You know, it's kind of when you ask someone in Germany, you know, triathlon, they're like, oh, well, have you done Kona? And it's like, you know, Kona and triathlon seem synonymous. It's a bit, well, I always like to say, it's the Wimbledon of our sport. It's the biggest event, and everybody, whether they do or don't do triathlon, seem to know about Hawaii and the race. So that was phenomenal and a wonderful time to be experiencing that, you know, almost, well, 7 years after the Olympics, and having moved on a bit and having a family and being a bit more firmly standing in my own shoes. It was really cool to be able to experience something like that again.
So last year you come back to Kona to defend your title, and you and Sebastian are together during the early part of the run. There's a little chatting going on. Sebastian seemed to be in a really good place. He actually told me after he won in 14, he said, you know, Jan didn't have his good day. I want to beat Jan on his best day. And I'm sure you're the same. You want to beat somebody when they're at their best. What were you guys talking about?
I was just trying to slow him down. He was just going out like, you know, like we were going for the first to be back to Lava Java. I thought we were running for a round of coffees. He took off quite fast. I actually managed to make up some time out of transition this time. I'd learned from my earlier mistakes and dropped my suit first time around. And when he ran up to me and came straight past, you know, I was on the ropes. I was hurting, and to be honest, I was trying to involve him in a bit of conversation. You know, he was asking about Lionel Sanders and how far he's back, and I'm like, dude, there's like 20 other guys. Well, what about their splits? And that maybe got him thinking a little bit. Anyways, I was trying to get into his head, anything to break his focus and his, you know, iron will just a little bit, and you know, that all being said, we are good mates, and sort of we know if we're racing together and putting time into the other guys, then that's already a good start for both of us.
So when you're from the outside, you looked very in control, you looked very comfortable, but when I chatted with you afterwards, you were like, I didn't know if I was going to be able to go another mile. I mean, there was points in that day that you didn't think you had it.
Yeah, and please don't take me wrong, this is not meant to sound cocky or anything like that, but I had a horrible day. It was okay. No, really, it was one of those days when you take a whole year and you focus your entire season to focus on one day, and you just don't feel great. You know you've got the strength, you know you've done the miles, you know you've done the training, but well, we've all seen it on your little home loop. Some days you've just got good days and it just flows along and you reckon you can break any record, and other days you just have to work for it. And it was one of those days where obviously my motivation and my willpower was there and my mind was rested, but I don't know where my legs decided to not show up. You know, it's kind of, as a defending champion, you want to be up there, you want to be aggressive on the bike, you want to, you know, really, yeah, I was just playing defense. You know, Luke McKenzie went up the road and I gave everything I had and a little bit more just to try and bridge the gap. And it was a very, very tough day, which of course, in hindsight, then makes it very rewarding.
Yes.
But it does put up the questions as to where, you know, where you went wrong, or maybe that's just what Hawaii is about. Maybe that's just, it's like Paris-Roubaix of cycling, you know? You just don't feel good. You feel good when you're finished. It could just be that that's the key to Hawaii.
Has anybody here ever felt great throughout that whole day? Yeah, I don't see any hands. Was it sweeter winning the second time? Because it's hard to defend. You know, winning once is great, and being able to defend when everybody's picking you, everybody picks, you know, someone in Kona who's won it, that they're going to win it again.
Yeah, that's a little bit the difficulty. You go there and sort of almost before you start the race, according to everyone, it's your race to lose. People expect a lot, and even though I've got expectations for myself, it's really difficult to blend that out completely, to just focus on only your own race. You know, people do get into your head a little bit, and I would say it was a big relief to win again, and a big learning curve, but probably the first time was the special one so far.
The other thing you did last year is you went to Challenge Roth for the first time, and that's one of my favorite events in the world. It's 4,000 individuals, 1,500 people on relay teams. In the little town of Roth, there's 14 hotel rooms total. There's like no hotels. Everybody camps, everybody does homestays. It's an amazing experience. You go there specifically, I'm assuming, to break the existing course record, right? And the course record, the iron distance record. That was the motivation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a really, really cool weekend. You know, you kind of get used to being chauffeured around, you see the great hotels, you see this and all the fancy things, and next thing you know, you're going to one of the biggest races in the world, and you move into someone's basement for a homestay. And it was so cool. You know, it was really, really something very special. The Valsurfer family take great care and pride in their event. And it was absolutely unique from the get-go. But yeah, it was something where I went specifically saying before, you know, I wanna get the fastest time ever. I do want to go and see what this course is all about. And despite what people think, it is 179.8 Ks, so it's 200 meters shy. I think that's good enough. That was definitely a big day in my career.
So 45:22 for the swim, 4:09:22 for the bike, 2:40:35 for the marathon, 7:35:39. How about a round of applause? Wow. Now, was that one of those days where everything seemed to flow, or same type of thing as Kona, where it was hard?
Oh, it's always hard, but that was definitely one of those days, you know, when you have moments when you're just within yourself. You feel like you're on top of the pedals and everything feels smooth, and it's just one of those days that you wish for, you know, when everything goes right, the temperature was perfect, it was a little bit overcast, and of course, you know, the last 10Ks, you just wish it was all over, but really, that's where I came from, and it was those memories and that muscle memory that I had that sort of got me to expect that I might feel something similar in Kona, and maybe that's why it was, one of those reality checks when on the second weekend of October. It's just a little bit harder than anywhere else in the world, but I guess that's, you know, why there are so many athletes that do amazing performances all over the world, but in Hawaii are never quite able to capitalize on their true form.
So goals for this year?
My one and only goal for this year is to nail Kona. That's really, and that's not tied to a result, that's not tied to a specific time, it's tied to the process of getting there, tied to trying to achieve excellence every day, and going there in my very, very best shape. I've chosen a race that's a little bit sooner, tiny bit sooner, than Roth or Frankfurt in previous years. I think, I'm sorry, I can only say what it is tomorrow because, well, you know, announcing all these
things. There's nobody here.
There's nobody here. Camera, lights off.
You guys promised not to tell?
Anyways.
Was sworn to secrecy.
So it gives me a little bit more time to rebuild, and everything is just focused also in my mindset on this one day. Last year, like we said, there was definitely always the thought of trying to get a world record in between. And you don't just do that on the fly, you know, yeah. you pay for it in the season, and having to do a third Ironman full distance race definitely hurts, and it's something that I'm really, really looking forward to. My whole mindset and everything is on the island already, you know, when I do intervals, when I think of race strategies and all these kinds of things, I'm looking forward to the 14th of October.
So this was the first year you've been in Kona with Luca, right? It was the first time Luca's been there. How fun was that, being there with your little boy?
Yeah, it was pretty cool. The little man has definitely changed our world and changed my perspective on things again. And he learned to crawl on the island, so it was, you know, very exciting time for us. But the most amazing thing was definitely the night before the race, you know, when really your heart drops lower and lower and you start getting stressed and you think about all the scenarios of the next day of what could go well, but also what could go wrong, and, you know, just reflecting on all the pressure. And the little man looked at me and smiled, and I was just like, he doesn't care. He does not care. He knows that the prize money will be good enough to get him his new play castle, and that's all he cares about. And it was the biggest relief. It was a truly unique moment that, you know, I think parents can probably relate to. It's just something I'm grateful to have experienced, and something that took a lot of weight off my shoulders in that very moment.
I love that. And for folks who don't know, so your wife, Emma Snowsill, who I still feel, if Emma had ever gotten to Kona, she would have been a multi-time champion. Emma, being there in Kona, and does she get anxious to feel like that she wants to race again? And how is she as a spectator at this type of thing?
She's very honest, which means that if I suck, she'll tell me, which is what you want. It's great to have that kind of perspective, to have that kind of excellence besides you that just can appreciate what you do and what needs to go on. I'm very, very grateful to have found her and have her help along the line to get me to the start and get me through the races. And it's just amazing that we can, you know, also share that as a family and go to Kona and do the whole thing as a family.
Whose gold medal has priority in the house?
If I tell you that Emma doesn't know where her gold medal is, it's become one of those things over the years that the medals and the trophies and all of these things are great. And as much as I enjoyed that time, you know, having my medal in the pocket all the time, in the end, it's not what counts. It's the memories, it's the friendships, it's the unique experiences that really carry you. And that's where the medals don't really take that much precedence, and we don't actually have any medals on expose anywhere in any of our homes.
How about a round of applause for Mr. Jan Frodeno taking quality time to be with us. So the race Saturday, got a little race on Saturday. What are the plans for Saturday?
Yeah, like I say, it's a unique moment to not have been injured in February, which I'm really excited about. It is at the moment I'm very happy with where I am in April, realizing that October is the big one. Of course, Lionel Sanders being here, you know, he is probably the most competitive guy in 70.3 at the moment, which to be honest is what gets me fired up. You know, racing right. The best guys, you want to be there, you want to. See a good race, and I hope that's what we'll get to do on Saturday.
One other thing. In Kona, people always talk about the heat and the wind and all the rest of it. I always feel that really what makes that race special is the competition, because it's so deep. A lot of races, there's two or three guys who can win. There's 20 guys there who've been in the top 10 at some point or another. Do you agree with that, that the competition is just what makes that race so special?
Yeah, definitely. You see a lot of guys... not a lot, but you always see a handful of guys who lose that race at race briefing, because it's a fierce room to be in. Some of the fittest people in the world, and have a bit of a stare down, you know, and the whole friendly shake. But there is always a bit of fierceness to us. Don't get me wrong, and it's definitely what makes the race unique. You know, Ironman is becoming a huge brand. We've got races all over, which is a cool opportunity to see the world. But of course, it does dilute the pro fields a little bit, and you don't get to see guys all the time. So it's very good. That's what a world championship is all about, having the best guys face off and hopefully having a great race.
So Javier Gomez, who obviously has already won Ironman 70.3 Worlds, we got the Brownlee brothers, Richard Murray, Mario Mola. Assuming a lot of those guys might be stepping up 70.3 and full distance, who do you think has the best chance of being great?
I still look at Javier as being the guy, especially for Kona. You know, I think Alistair for now, I think Jonathan isn't quite thinking about stepping up yet. Is an absolutely awesome athlete, but if there is a chink in his armor anywhere, it's ever been the heat, which gives us hope. he's a very fierce competitor and the greatest ever Olympic distance racer. You know, you can say that hands down, two Olympic gold medals. But I do think that Javier is a very, very complete athlete. He's a very balanced athlete, and he has gone well in the heat. So he could be the toughest nut to crack.
Love it. Again, another round of applause for Mr. Jan Frodeno. Thank you, man.
Photo and then, you know.